we have a bunch of animals in the movie, and the one thing we quickly learned is none of them gave a shit what we were doing.
In a great way. Yeah, yeah. Really, it's great, a wonderful way. Because yeah. we're wondering, how would they react to the someone a Bigfoot costume? And the answer is they don't care at all. They just wanted food.
Hello, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America. In this episode, a family of Sasquatches embarks on an epic journey in directors David and Nathan Zellner's adventure comedy, Sasquatch Sunset. The film tells the story of a family of Sasquatches living in the misty forests of North America. Over the course of 1 year, they embark on an absurdist, epic, hilarious, and ultimately poignant journey as they fight for survival in an ever-changing world. In addition to Sasquatch Sunset, the Zellner Brothers' other directorial credits include the feature films Damsel, Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, Kid Thing, and episodes of The Curse. Following a screening of the film at the DGA Theater in Los Angeles, the Zellner Brothers spoke with director James Ponsoldt about filming Sasquatch Sunset. Listen on for their spoiler-filled conversation.
Hey, guys.
Hey, James.
Thank you for making such an incredible film. Let's give him another round of applause, please.
Thanks.
I have a lot of questions for you. I wanted to ask you about tone first, because I love everything y'all make, and the tone is always so specific, and I always laugh a lot, as I did in this, and there's deadpan humor, but then I found myself in this film getting very sad in a way that was a bit, I wasn't totally prepared for how human it was going to feel, and feel almost aspirational for me of how simple life could be, like a life without neurosis or guilt or a need to like make money or check my iPhone all the time. It's just such a precise tone. And I was curious if you could talk about the tone of the film and how you two talk about tone, which I assume is basically subliminal between the two of you, but how you talk with your creative collaborators and like your business collaborators who are going to finance your films.
That's a good question. Well, yeah, for us between us, it's just kind of intuitive. I think just because we've been making stuff together since we were kids. But, for this, you know, cause there's not like a easy go-to comp for this film. It was crucial, like from the script stage, that there was absolute clarity in the tone we're going for, because from the start we knew it was going to be a mix of the broader comedy with poignant moments in equal measure. And I think, I mean, all of our films have that to a degree, but this was pushed even further in each direction. And we're just kind of like looking at how we wanted to like embrace the full spectrum of the human condition kind of through these Sasquatches. Just wanted to be open to whichever direction it went, and not like, it felt like it would kind of cheapen it if we pulled it back. We knew the humor, we knew we were from the start. I mean, the humor is what kind of started the impetus for it initially, just because like there's so much stuff in this film basically it's very similar to behavior that if you saw your dog or cat do, you would think nothing of it. But when you see these human like creatures do, it's much more uncomfortable and absurd. And there's something fascinating to us about that. But then, you know, it was crucial that you, to connect with them on an emotional level. And so it wasn't just like a one note, you know, joke that the broader stuff was kind of an entry point, but that you see some similarities in them, to us, and have some kind of connection. So yeah, we always knew we wanted it to go both ways with that. But, so it was with the script, we made that crystal clear, because it wasn't just, I mean, for the cast, for the crew, and then for the financiers to get on board with this, we had to, you know, make, make that as dialed in as we could. And also we knew that we always knew we wanted to be from the perspective of the Sasquatches, which was a big part of the tone, because we wanted to be immersed in their world kind of without judgment, and there's no shame amongst them. So just kind of objectively, you know, embrace that their qualities, and and always like have humans be kind of at the backdrop.
Do the two of you, I mean, how are the two of you always in sync, or are there disagreements about tone, and what does that look like when you're developing a story and then on set when you're directing together? Yeah,
I don't think there's any disagreements on tone, just because we have like a shorthand that we've been working on for 45 years or so since we were kids. We always kind of reference the same movies that we grew up on, the same things that inspired us. And when either of us have an idea, it's really easy to kind of like explain that to the other. And all of our films, I think we've lived with, we don't do anything that, you know, we write it and then we shoot it the next day. Like we kind of gestate for a while. For all these different reasons.
Sometimes not by choice, because it takes so long to raise the money for it.
Yeah. So David wrote this script about almost 10 years
ago. First draft.
Yeah, first draft of it. And then we've just been talking about it for so long. Then by the time we're, you know, casting or crewing up or whatever it is, we're so eager to talk to somebody else about it. And we're already kind of like way on the same page of, you know, what collectively we're hoping it will be. And then, so it's really simple when we get to that, like we don't even really think about it, but it's sort of like, it's really easy for us to like explain it to other people and get them to see the collective vision.
Well, I think the key with it for us is we kind of like set kind of parameters of, or like the movie is kind of between here and here, but then within that it leaves room for everyone to, you know, to kind of personalize it in their own way. And then it's our job just to know what the tone is, but then of equal importance to be able to articulate that to everyone. Cause if we're not communicating that, then there's like five different movies being made. I think it's very intuitive to us, which like when, if something's leaning more towards the comedic or more towards the dramatic, I think whichever feels more truth to it, you know, whichever feels more real and isn't forced. I think what dictates it a lot is if we're feeling like we're trying to just force it for narrative convenience one way or the other. And then something about it, even if it's something, you know, stylized or absurd or whatever, there's something that feels kind of false. And that often dictates us pushing something in a different direction.
I mean, the rhythm of your films is so precise and the comedy of it is so patient, but so perfectly calibrated. Like I'm thinking of sequences in this, like the turtle, like there's like, you know, affection and then pain and then salvation and then comfort, you know, or them having sex and then cleaning themselves off. And then the deadpan, just forest animals, and the other two just staring at them, not moving, sort of Rorschach testing us as an audience. Like, what are they thinking while they're watching this? All these things, but they're just so perfectly measured and play out. Do you, on the page, is that rhythm exactly there? Is that something, I mean, you're in the edit. How do you, can you talk about the rhythm of the comedy, I would say?
Well, it's as much as possible. On the page, it was laid out with the beats. I mean, the script is very, very visual, and so much of it is broken on my shots because you don't have the dialogue to push the exposition. It was almost made more like a silent film script in some ways. So I just think in terms of conveying what's going on and the tone and everything, it was, especially stuff like that with the comedic beats, it was very specific in the rhythm. And so everyone is on the same page going in. That said, you know, once you get the actors there on the day and everything, you know, stuff, doesn't always, you know, go as you planned. And the way we do things is we try to be as prepared as possible, and have a good foundation that we're working off of, but then the willingness and ability to, you know, to adapt when either we're forced to change something based on, you know, circumstantial things or just something once you get, you know, everyone together, something much better comes than what you had initially planned.
Yeah. Like the sex scene was written with the two just kind of watching and just kind of like observing. And then one of our B unit days, David and I and our DP just went out and got a bunch of footage of nature shots. And there's a ton of these huge elk that just don't really care about you at all. And so we were able to capture them on some long lens footage. And then just like their nonplus reactions made sense to edit in as if they're watching the sex scene as well. So that was like what David's saying, like adapting in the edit room with some of the other footage that we got. It's kind of played the joke up a little bit.
I mean, I love that because it's like the comedy, so much of it at times is utter that nature is indifferent to a lot of things. Yeah, yeah. And that is what is so funny. Like we find our humanity and then it just, nature really doesn't care about us at all, which I love.
That's why we have a bunch of animals in the movie. And the one thing we quickly learned is none of them gave a shit what we were doing.
In a great way. Yeah. Yeah. Really, it's great, a wonderful way. Yeah. Cause we're wondering how would they react to the someone, a Bigfoot costume. And the answer is they don't care at all. They just wanted food.
You know, I love the short film, that y'all made 14, 15 years, Sasquatch Birth Journal 2. And which is amazing. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. And I've never asked you guys this, but I mean, I imagine like between that and this, I have a vision of you as like, this is probably not true, but as children, like just obsessed with myth and storytelling and Sasquatch and the idea of it, like clearly it's been in your consciousness for a long time. When did you initially get fascinated with the idea of the mythology of Sasquatch?
We've loved Sasquatch and Bigfoot since we were little kids. There was this show on in the 70s called In Search Of that Leonard Nimoy hosted that we loved. And that was the first time we learned about Bigfoot, but then it was such a fixture in pop culture, you know, on different, you know, TV shows and movies. I mean, yeah, most of the time it's either, you know, a family film or a horror film, and always from the perspective of humans. So we knew from the start of this, we wanted to be immersed in the world, like we were saying, but, and so I think, so in that regard, we're very influenced by, I don't know, there's a lot of like nature documentaries, especially anything with Jane Goodall. And then also like the Donna Man sequence in 2001, we've always been, or just that whole movie, but in regard to this film, that sequence was a big inspiration as well.
Can you talk, this is a craft question, but about your collaboration with your cinematographer? I know his work with David Robert Mitchell and Jordan Peele and M. Night Shyamalan, but there's such gorgeous tableaus of like this arrangement of four shots that then become three shots. As the movie goes on, two shots, and it's like, oh my God, you're killing all of the men. Like all the, it's just that they're all going to die. Or you're going to kill the child. Like, but, can you talk about just sort of, I mean, do you storyboard? What were those conversations like? How just arranging these very patient compositions, you know?
It was a great collaboration with we always screw up his last name, but Mike Gillakis. We had such a great time with him, and we, even though this is the first film we did together, we quickly had a shorthand, and it was I mean, the script is almost like shot listed in a lot of ways, but so that gave us a foundation to work with. But then, you know, when you're scouting for these locations and it's like woods, you know, you got to dive, then you need to get more specific based on what the realities are that you're finding out there. But, so I think, you know, it evolved with his involvement, and, sometimes we had to do it on the fly, and then sometimes it was storyboarded. Just with weather changes and everything, we had to do, a lot of quick adapting. But then something like the river sequence, which was the most difficult part of the film, that was something that was heavily storyboarded.
Yeah, that and then the Dave did draw a crude drawing of the birth scene.
That was specific. How
just
we
to kind of get like the placement of the two characters. But Mike was great in terms of, you know, we would be out there and it was all natural lighting. Like we didn't have a light kit or anything. And so,
for little things, but yeah, most of it.
But we would, you know, like if something looked, you know, if the light was shining through the trees a certain way over here, we'd like quickly like move the set because like David said, it was just like a tree or something like that. And find like that he was really great at like finding like the best of every inch of the forest that we were in.
Can you talk about, I mean, working with the actors, Nathan, obviously you can speak to it in a specific way. I've worked with both Jesse and Riley before, who are both brilliant, but I'm just, what was that collaboration like? How did you, you know, conversations about movement, about how they would sound, you know, all of the above, you know?
Yeah, Jesse was the first to get on board. David sent him the script and you know, he got it right away. And we like Jesse and Riley because they've got a you know, they're great at both comedy and drama. And we knew that we wanted actors inside the makeup because of there's a lot of emotion in this, as opposed to like, you know,
just a stunt performer.
Just a stunt performer. Yeah. So the first thing we did was we had these Zoom sessions where we were kind of like just trying to figure out what they sounded like and what they looked like. Cause we were making up a species, you know, we were kind of like, there's not the only footage of Sasquatch is it walking, you know, even the stuff on YouTube that they capture now, it's just walking. And that was, so we kind of had to like, come up with our own rules for the creature. And so we spent like, we came up with some vocalizations and the way that like very simple kind of like dialogue grunts and stuff that they would say to each other. And some came up with whooping and some of it was based on a lot of primate videos that we saw online as well. And then
Jesse brought in a movement coach.
So when we were together finally for rehearsing, we had like a few days where we were just rolling on the floor in this office in Northern California, just shoving ferns in each other's mouths and throwing food at each other and hitting each other with sticks. And then, so we got really, really feral and like primates. And the great part about that is once we kind of got that technical stuff down and we were all sort of like the same species, everyone was able to kind of like put their own spin or add to or enhance the character. You know, like Jesse described himself as the poet of the group, which I thought was great. And, you know, my character was just kind of all id and just very selfish and more like your stereotypical beast in the woods. And so then when we got on set though, like we didn't have to like, it wasn't like talking about like, oh no, the Sasquatch would move like this. It was all about character and all about like directing like a normal film.
Do you have like, I'm like, as far as the, I'm going to call it creature design, but there's a better way of describing it. But when I think of, you know, our mutual friend, David Lowery, like when he did Pete's Dragon, I felt like one of the innovations he did from the original was to make it a Shaggy Dog story, put fur on a dragon, you know, or I think of the live action, you know, Jungle Book or Lion Kings, and where there's more or less emotion that you get out of an animal's face, you know, and I'm curious sort of, as you were talking about the design of the face, how, because animals in nature don't emote that much enough to be that interesting. So how did you sort of have those conversations? How much did you need from the eyes? How much, you know, did you need the cheeks and mouth to be able to move? What were those conversations like?
Well, the eyes were a key thing that we early on decided we didn't want like contacts or to do VFX eyes on it because they just kind of look dead behind them, you know, and for some things it works great. But for this, it's just amazing how much, I mean, it's obvious, but how much information you can telegraph through one's eyes that if they, you know, had contacts or something like that, it would just not give any information at all. And so, yeah, and it was an added bonus that three of the, everyone except Nathan's character has very blue eyes. And so they just really popped out, especially, Riley's, which were just so, so big. And she just had such a soulful quality, to them that conveyed just, yeah, so much about her character with like the subtlest glance. And then, you know, then the rest of the appliances on the face were kept thin enough to where they could, you know, work through them. But I remember Jesse talking about like, it was counterintuitive in some ways because he had to kind of, overact in some ways just to be able to like work through the makeup. And that was kind of a learning process for all of them.
And then can you talk about, I mean, you created so many hurdles for yourself in this film. There are so many actual real animals in this film too. Can you talk about, I mean, snakes, skunks, mountain lion? I mean, like, what was that process like? How many different animal wranglers were there? What was actually being Yeah, can you talk about that process? I assume, yeah.
Well, there was a lot of different wranglers. It was a combination of tricks from compositing, you know, animals and some green screen stuff, and then just having them out there. But basically, kind of the way anytime we've worked with animals, it's like they kind of run the show. You know, it's like we cast them based on what they will want to do. And if they don't want to do that, then we just don't do it, or we change, we adapt or whatever. But mostly they all evolved around them eating. So, you know, all of these things. So they didn't, there's no crazy tricks they had to do. I mean, the one thing is the porcupine came from this. There was this rescue zoo that had a lot of, that had animals that people had foolishly tried to have as pets, that, and then this was like a kind of an educational center where they would you know, take care of them but the animals were familiar with humans because of where they came from. So, in this instance, the porcupine knew how to wave, and she said, "Oh, by the way, the porcupine can wave." And we're like, "All right, we'll work that in." You know, it's just, so there's like some extra things like that. But for the most part, it was just working with what they wanted to do. I mean, the mountain lion was the trickiest, and that was composited in and things like that. Because we didn't know how, I don't think they would have cared. They didn't seem, we didn't know how they'd react to the Sasquatch costumes, but we just, to play it safe, we just had the Sasquatches offset when they were around.
Can you talk also, you know, it's a film obviously that moves over seasons, but it also sort of tonally, like for me, when I was watching the film, the first time, like when they come upon that red X, like it was like a jolt to the heart, you know, and it felt like suddenly, you know, the encroachment of man in their world, it was becoming a horror film for them. And there are these, you know, the film gained depth and complexity and the layers of genre, both with that when they come to the road and they want to destroy it with urine and defecate on it. And also, you know, there's also this parallel story of, I'm going to call him the child. I'm assuming he's an adolescent, early. Well, I don't know what age, yeah, whatever Sasquatch age he is. But he, you know, the talking hand, you know, and he's like, we're seeing the birth of what? Self-awareness, a different type of consciousness, of characters trying, bursting at the seams to like articulate themselves or count the stars and not really able to do it. Can you talk about that, about characters who are not people suddenly coming in contact with the stuff of people or the thinking modalities of humanity?
No, that's a good question. I mean, so much of this was exploring like kind of the gray area between human and animal behavior and how the Sasquatches represent that. And so it just seemed, you know, something like the talking of the hand was, you know, it seemed like an interesting way to explore like, yeah, this other level of consciousness in a certain way. But then it's also, something that we did as kids, and it's just like, it feels like a very childlike thing to do that with the hand puppet. So that would seem like an interesting thing to explore that with Jesse's character with the counting. It was like, but it felt very relatable in this, Promethean kind of way of like reaching for something that's out of your league, basically, and just something, the futility of what, like wanting to, trying to like have this greater understanding of the world around him by tabulating it, but it was such a futile effort, you know, because it was everything he was trying to, or it was way beyond his capabilities, especially with like the stars or something like that. So there was something both relatable and absurd with that. And I mean, and with the humans from the start, we knew that we never wanted to see the humans. We thought it was much more interesting if their impact, it was what you were exposed to. And it just felt like it'd be almost like the reverse of like a horror film or something where like the creatures are the boogeyman. In this case, it was the humans that were this kind of outside boogeyman, you know, kind of force that you were feeling. And it just felt much more unnerving if you're seeing it through the impact rather than the people themselves.
Yeah. It was like a hurdle for us was we really wanted people to connect with these creatures and legitimize them as much as possible. So being, you know, shooting out in their natural habitat, you know, doing it, putting them with animals and making them feel as real as we could so that you would be invested with them emotionally. And so, you know, that played also into the decision to never show a human being. Cause I think that even if it was in the last scene, if you showed a human, the audience would instantly be like, oh, I'm supposed to be on their side, mm. you know, and abandon, you know, everything that they'd been on, I think. Mm. So that's, yeah.
Well, and so much of this, we wanted to kind of, take the creatures and normalize them or naturally have it much of a naturalistic kind of feel to it, even though, you know, there's plenty of things, elements that are stylized and heightened. We, you know, which is why we wanted to use the prosthetic, you know, creature design. It's why we wanted a set in all on location. There's no like sets or anything like that. And usually most time with creature work, it's like on a more controlled environment with a soundstage, and that it made it much more difficult filming, but there's something, it helped to kind of legitimize the creatures more by taking these mythical creatures and putting them in real landscapes in these like redwood forests that were, you know, over 1,000 years old, you know, with real animals, everything else around them had a naturalistic kind of feel to help, you know, kind of lend that quality to them.
Can you talk about, the Octopus Project, who, you've the collective that have done that have scored most of your films. Mm-hmm. The score is remarkable, in the film. It's a character in it. It has so much soul. And can you talk about the way that you work with them?
I think this is like our fourth or fifth movie with them. So we've got a really good collaboration with them. And we actually sent them the script before we even started filming. And I think they started, you know, they got the tone and started working on some different, you know, musical beds. They visited us up in Humboldt with their, and then went on like little excursions out in the forest, banging on trees. And they had this device that could get like electric readings off of, mushrooms and
or anything, any plant,
any organic material. And it turned it into like MIDI sounds. And like, so all that apparently is mixed into the score as well. So there's all these like natural sounds and natural tree thumpings for drums and stuff, which is really cool. But by the time we got into editing, they had like, you know, here's all these examples and here's all these things. And we just kind of refined it from there. And sometimes they would score a few scenes very specifically. And sometimes we would say, that's great, but we're going to not use it in that scene. We're going to use it over here.
A completely different part.
Yeah.
So, well, and the kind of the guidelines for them on it. These are kind of, I don't know, maybe deep cut references. I don't know, but like we said, we want it to feel like, had this kind of ethereal quality. It was sort of a mix between, German krautrock group called Popol Vuh, which did a lot of Werner Herzog's films through the 70s, had this kind of psychedelic ethereal quality, and then mixed that with, this Miles Davis album I love called Bitches Brew the references were from the same time period in the 70s, but just something, I don't know. I can't really explain why. It just felt what the way to go musically.
It all for me, like between that or the Erasure song, which is used as like the soundtrack to like horror freak out for them. or I mean, even, you know, Riley, you know, her song at the end, which to me just feels like a lost Karen Dalton, Vashti Bunyan, sort of outsider folk song. Uh-huh. It all is of a piece. Can you talk about, you know, that end credit song?
Secretly I like to write songs. And so I wanted it to be this have this kind of 60s folk feel to it and a real ethereal quality. I wrote the lyrics and then sang the melody in the iPhone, and I can't carry a tune and I can't play any instruments, but that was the extent of it. And then gave that to Octopus Project, and then they turned it into something. And then, Riley has such an incredible voice. I remember talking to you because you worked with her, and she just knocked out of the park. So
I think we have to wrap it up in a second, but I want to ask you both, do both of you have a favorite scene, and is it the same scene? I'm assuming not, but I'm curious.
I don't know. Each time I don't know. Yeah, I don't think I have one. It was such a fun, it was in some ways, it was the most difficult film we've ever made, but it was so fun. Everyone we worked with was so great. And everyone was, because everyone was dialed into the tone, it made our jobs so much easier as filmmakers, because we weren't having to write. It gave everyone a certain sense of freedom, and they were contributing, you know, in a way that was, you know, cohesive for the film. So I don't know. There's a lot of scenes I like. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to pick a favorite scene, but we everybody in the crew would always have the same thing at the end of the day, like, oh, this is the best day ever. I can't believe what we did today. It just felt like we were doing something that every day was something you hadn't seen before, and like was like a new experience and a new challenge. So it was, yeah, super difficult technically and with the weather. But it was one of the best and most fun collaborations we've had. Yeah.
I mean, I love the berry patch scene. That was really fun. I really liked that. And then the campsite scene was very fun too. So, but I don't know. We liked a lot.
Will there be any more Sasquatch stories in your future?
I'd love to. It was fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to another DGA Q&A. The Director's Cut is available wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and you can help fellow film buffs find the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America.